Roadman, welcome to the podcast, Fiola Foley. Let's cue that intro.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Roadman, welcome back to another Roadman Cycling Podcast. Thanks for joining me. It's the Wednesday interview episode. I always say it, but I love the Wednesday interview episode. I get to talk with such amazing, interesting people that would happily pass me by in a bar or on the street, and I'd never be able to pick their brain. But because of the weird wonderance of the internet, I get to talk with just these amazing people with amazing stories to tell. If you haven't checked out last week's interview episode with Sammy Sowry, it's a brilliant one to go back and listen to, because she's someone who just inspires adventure in you. If you have an adventure that you're kind of sitting on the fence thinking, will I, won't I, Sammy will hopefully light the spark. And this week's guest will hopefully turn that spark into a fire. This week's guest is Fiola Foley. She's represented Ireland in rowing and cycling. She's just had some of the coolest jobs, including head of global communications at BMC. She worked at Rowan Dennis's 24-hour record. She's director of media relations at the moment for one of my favorite companies at the moment, Komoot. Komoot are like an alternative to Strava, but just way cooler. Think what Strava could have been before they got wrapped up in all these segments and shit like that. It's just such a cool prospect, and it's a company I'm keeping a really close eye on. But as I said, like how Fiola builds on Sammy Samri's episode, she's an adventurer, and I'd almost call her a lifestyle design expert, having lived a nomadic existence for a good part of her life since leaving her native Killorglin for the US on a scholarship at the tender age of 17. Roadman, I am super privileged and honoured to welcome to the podcast Fiola Foley.
Hi Anthony, how's it going? Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem, I'm looking forward to chatting. We were chatting for a few minutes before I hit record, and I feel like we could have chatted for an hour before I pressed record, so I was like, I better press record fast here.
I know.
You have an interesting background, which I think we'll get into your cycling exploits in a little bit, but I think a nice place to start is your rowing exploits, because when I was researching the podcast, I didn't realize prior to, we chatted a few times last week, and I hadn't realized you were such a superstar rower.
Oh yeah, superstar. I don't know about that. I don't know. What's superstar by definition?
people around Kerry know your name.
Oh, I was once told I'm the most famous person in Killorglin, but I think I've been knocked off that rung on the ladder now, because one of the two girls from Killorglin have qualified for the Olympics, actually, in rowing, Monica Dekarska and Aileen Crowley. So the next generation has come along and outperformed me on the fame level.
Do you feel like you've paved the way a little bit for them? They kind of can't see me, can't be me.
It all kind of came home there recently when we did a going away party for them for the Olympics, because we were at the boat club and I realised, oh my, rowing has come so, like, such a long way in Killorglin, because I started when I was 14 in coastal rowing, and that's all that really existed back then was coastal rowing with big wooden boats with big wooden oars, and you rowed obviously off, you know, it was offshore rowing off the coast of Ireland. And I, like, when I was about 15 or 16, I just started, like, reading some stuff about, like, Stephen Redgrave and Matthew Pinsent, and they became my heroes, these British heavyweight guys that had, you know, won loads of medals at the Olympics. And I thought, oh, I'd like to start, maybe try some single sculling. And just so happened a guy in town had a single scull, so I borrowed his boat and I started single sculling, and I really liked it. And then the son of the guy that had the rowing club had actually rowed in the UK a little bit and knew a little bit about, you know, how to, the technique behind single sculling. So there was no club, there's no boathouse. I used to wade into the water up to my knees in the freezing cold in winter, and I put the boat in myself. So sometimes there would be no one out in the water with me, and there I was rowing up and down the river, really enjoying myself. And I started, like, racing at regattas, and then I guess I was pretty strong anyway from like racing summers in coast throwing and a bit of basketball and stuff like that. And I started winning races and I was fast tracked onto the Irish junior team. And it just kind of took off from there. And then I rode until I was 25, more or less full time. Then after graduating from Boston University, I got a scholarship.
Yeah, I've seen that. So you got a scholarship. So I feel like you lived the life I almost took. I was like a decentish soccer player and I was tossing around the idea. I'd been offered a couple of scholarships and I was tossing around the idea of going to the US, and then I went to UCD instead. But I often wonder at that crossroads, like, would I be sitting in an SUV with the 2.4 children living in the suburbs of Chicago with a white picket fence if I had taken that scholarship?
When Bush got elected president for the second time, I knew that my relationship with the States would come to a ground to a halt. I was like literally in my fourth year in college, like as a senior, they call them senior in, you know, in America. And I remember like going, oh my God, Bush is president again. I don't think I can live here. So anyway, I went back to Ireland because like the rowing career was calling and stuff. So yeah.
And so what was sort of the crowning highlights for the rowing career you look back on? Is it the big achievements or is it smaller stuff? Like you've been world championships, Olympics.
So yeah, it's always so bittersweet, I suppose, that level, because especially with rowing, you can come so close, yet you don't quite make it. So I would say probably the best performances I had were at under 23 level. Like I came very close to medals at the under 23 World Championships. I came fourth. It was a bit of a unfair final. They actually reorganized the seating of the lanes after my race because of the way the wind was blowing. So was lucky but unlucky there, but felt really good. It was a really good lifetime when I was really performing well. And then had like quite a few successes at World Cup level, and I think narrowly missing out on Olympic qualification was really tough. So, I mean, when you talk about like how good you did in rowing, it's always like, I mean, I was at that level where, you know, we were constantly like top 10 in the world. Like, I mean, it was...
Well, isn't it the nature of the athlete? I chatted to Sven Tuft a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and he'd won the team time trial with Green Edge in the Giro d'Italia up in Belfast, and he'd taken the Maglia Rosa. But it's like the nature of the athlete is we're almost never happy. We're looking ahead to the next thing, to the next event, how we could have done a little bit better or prepared a little bit better. And we also think those times are going to last forever and we're going to be that athlete forever. And you don't realize that there's a limited shelf life on it.
Yeah, like I think if you can't say in three words or four words, I was a world champion, you're not going to be happy, right? I mean, it's to have to say, well, in 2005, I was fourth in like this. I mean, you know, I mean, and I just actually listened to a podcast last week, an interview with Katie. I can't remember her second name. She's an Olympic swimmer. She was on the same American team as Michael Phelps back in when he was competing at his, you know, best. And she won three gold Olympic medals and she was disappointed with that performance. But that's her perspective. That's her, how she felt with her, because she knew herself and she knew what she was capable of. And she thought she could have done better, whether that was five Olympic medals. No, it was probably qualifying for the next Olympics, which she didn't make because she had like a lung, like a blood clot in her lung. And for me, I think I know that if I had the knowledge and experience that I have now, back when I was racing, I would have performed better, but I was a bit immature, I think, and I didn't realize that you only have a window of like really 8 years and you can just go for it during those 8 years. You can put everything to one side and I probably would have done better. You know, I was a bit maybe blasé about where I was and how good I was at the time.
In kind of my quest to become windswept and interesting, I'm reading a lot of Stoic philosophy at the moment. And there's this kind of concept of, it's, you know, in Ireland, we call it the grass is greener on the other side. But, you know, the Stoic philosophy around then back rolling back to Seneca's time. It's this idea of a hedonic treadmill where you're always looking for the next thing. So the trick that Stoics had to defeat this idea of always looking for the next thing, because, you know, I have clients who are, you know, multimillionaires, billionaires, and they're still looking for the next business venture. But the Stoic trick is to be happy with what you have. And so the daily practice they engage in is thinking of something you have at the moment. So even something as simple as, for me, I have a bike. And now imagining what life would be like if I didn't have that bike. And by that way, building gratitude around the things you have rather than always pushing down the line for something you don't have. Because it's such a recurring theme among athletes. I've had guys on of won stages in the Tour de France, and they'd win two stages in the Tour, and then they're disappointed that it wasn't three, or they're disappointed they didn't get a green jersey. And it's not a happy way to go through life.
Yeah, but isn't that a lot of like what mindfulness is about as well? I mean, when you look at how people are suffering from anxiety and maybe like that, the grass is greener on the other side is like, I'd say it's closely linked to anxiety, where you feel like you're not happy with what you have or where you're at this moment in time. You tend to project yourself into a different situation or scenario, and social media has a lot to do with that. But if you can be more present in the moment and just stop and think, look, I can't change right now what you have, and you should just appreciate what you have.
I think we're going to see a lot more. The impact of social media, I think, is just starting to be understood. I think we're going to see more longer term studies into the impact that's having on people, you know, on their self-confidence, on their even motivation to get up and going. Because I coach some athletes, and it's getting that initial momentum for them to get them started, because the people they're following on social media, they feel like they're at the destination, and then they look at their own lives and go, I'm so far away from this. Why even start? And I think we're just beginning to learn sort of the dangers of social media.
Yeah, I just read some studies like yesterday about the chemical effects of, it's not just dopamine, there are some other chemicals that are released when you engage with social media that are quite detrimental to your ability to concentrate. And it's a little bit like it helps, like it's a threat to ADD. Like you could get ADD from actually spending too much time on social media.
It's a huge problem for young riders trying to come through, because I'm coaching a number of young kids, and you're trying to say to them that logging kilometers, winning races, hitting power targets, these are the metrics we need to chase as athletes. It's not social media shares, likes, and followers. They're a different thing, and we're starting to conflate them. And it's maybe at this point I'll start drawing into some of your previous work experience with BMC, because I know there's a crossover between social media, and riders are becoming marketing tools to push bikes and to sell bikes. And there is naturally a crossover with how big is social followings, how well engaged is their following with their qualities on the bike. And we're at the beginning of quite a strange period, I think, in marketing and cycling and sport. And just a way of context for listeners, so you worked in BMC. I'm not exactly sure what your title was there, but what was your title in BMC?
I was head of global communications at BMC. So that basically, in that role, I was the liaison as well between the brand and the pro cycling teams. So that was the road cycling team, triathlon, enduro mountain bike, and cross country mountain bike. So I had a good bit to do with the pro riders. And then at the same time, I was coordinating all of the communications and a lot of marketing activities for like the different, for the dealers and for the end consumers, so riders basically.
So were you doing a lot of kind of forming and delivering the message around new bikes?
Oh, it was a lot of coordination of translations, to be honest. It was a lot of the hard graft, like, so we, you know, in the production of our catalogue and dealer book every year, all the translations, different languages, the social media posts, thing like blog on the website, newsletters, and then also communicating like on the successes of the teams. So when, like, you know, Greg Van Avermaet like would win a race, or Philip Schubert and stuff, on a Sunday, like it came into me to like then post that on the social media channels of BMC and to celebrate the success that they had riding BMC bikes.
And so, who came up with the name, the Time Machine? That must be the coolest name ever for a bike.
It was really difficult to run reports in terms of marketing for that bike, because we kept on getting a lot of the keywords for Apple Time Machine. The time machine, well, everything was like Team Machine, Time Machine, you know, Road Machine.
It was brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, definitely had some like good, like, you know, I mean, it was a Swiss brand, like very centered around design. So you're never going to get like the sort of, I suppose, dynamicism of like a West Coast American company with like Hey Bro. Like, it's very true to like being a Swiss company. So it was, it's really, really positive, like, time working there. I still have loads of contacts with, you
know. And I think it's a really interesting time you're there as well, because I know I always think, I lived in the States and Canada for a little bit, and I always think in Ireland, we just mimic their cultural changes and habits, but maybe 4 or 5 years later. And when I was over there in 2013, 2014, 2015, I remember seeing the amount of people that were on $5,000 plus bikes. It was almost everybody had a group ride. And then you come back to Ireland and guys are on like Trek 1000s and, you know, real entry level 900 euro bikes. And it seems like we were really slow in Ireland to
appreciate a good bike as well.
Yeah, appreciate quality craftsmanship and invest in nice equipment.
Well, it's actually a cultural thing, to be honest. The Swiss are very, Swiss, like by the GDP of Switzerland is quite higher when you compare it to a lot of other countries in Europe. So they do have the money, disposable income, but at the same time, there's a huge appreciation for design. And that is part of the Swiss identity. Like, it's Swiss design. They love that. I mean, coffee machines, bikes, cars, whatever it is, you know.
Fabio Cancellara.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, I know him pretty well. He's a friend of mine. But
he was made in a lab, I heard. He was genetically engineered in a lab.
And like, even Roger Federer, you're like, how do these guys keep going? I mean, they're amazing.
They're from test tubes. They're from another planet.
Oh, I don't know. They're fairly singular in their attitude as well. And that's also very Swiss, like, thing, you know, to be very driven, and they love endurance sports, and it's a passion, it's a hobby. They'll spend the money on their hobbies. I mean,
they also look like zero crack.
That's not true. They can different crack to Irish crack. Like, yeah, it's, once you get to know, like, you know, the Swiss, like, you can, you know, I've got some really good friends from there and stuff. But yeah, like, integration is definitely more difficult in Switzerland than it is for a lot of other European countries.
So are you glad you're out of BMC now, with you don't have the job of trying to convince the world that we need disc brakes on road bikes?
I thought the team would do that. That was the whole, that was a bit like the topic. The thing with BMC was like, we never really needed to do any marketing because, you know, it was just the best bike in the world, right? I mean, how can people argue against it? And if the team won races, well, then the job was done, you know. But that's all changed now with the onset of social media. And as you were saying, with, you know, brands working with influencers and ambassadors and bringing the product to the people through, like, you know, social media and stuff, which is good and it's bad at the same time.
So how frustrating is that for, say, you know, the problem with Pinarello, like, because you were in the role who would have had to head on deal with this. So you have the guys on the World Tour team in the Tour de France electing to ride the rim brakes. And then you, on the other hand, are trying to push a marketing campaign around selling these disc brakes. How much of a challenge does that pose?
Well, coming from a PR background, you just have to be very authentic and, like, honest with people. And, you know, in the bike industry, everyone knew that the bikes would go in the direction of disc brakes. The reason the pro riders and the teams weren't racing them enough was basically because of a holdup with the UCI. The UCI's, like, technological review was back in the day happening every, like, 3 or 4 years. So the bike brands had to wait 3 or 4 years before new products could be officially approved by the UCI for the Pro Peloton. So the holdup laid at the UCI, whereas the market was ready for that technology, and that happens quite often. The market is ready for the technology before you see the pro riders or pro teams racing with that technology. So, I mean, if it was up to like the UCI, if the UCI was driving, I'd say like the go-to-market strategies of bike brands, we'd still be 20 years behind, but in terms of technology.
If the UCI was doing anything, like their focus is on just the wrong place. Like their focus is on super tucks and sock lengths instead of rider safety and sprint finishes. But I think it's probably a conversation for another day.
Yeah, it's just the makeup of their organization and not being able to properly be agile enough to deal with circumstances as they arise and stuff. But now that they went. It's a process as well. You know, I guess equipment does need to be tested. It does need to be verified. And they need to be sure that it isn't dangerous. And it went through those rounds of processing. And to the point now where people are accepting disc brakes. But isn't that funny? Human nature in the beginning is also a bit suspicious of new technology. And then once it's had its time, it gets adopted fairly well. So.
Well, I flick back and forth between the two now because I have disc brakes on my gravel bike and I ride the gravel bike like 90% of the time because I ride it on the road, even in group rides and stuff. But when I race, obviously I'm racing back on my road bike with rim brakes. And I raced on Monday evening and I'd ridden the gravel bike for the previous 5 days. And the first time I was back on the road bike was just a warm up for the race. I was going around corners going, I can't stop. This is ridiculous. I can't stop at all.
Yeah. Like it's so, I love that though. It's kind of funny. Like I love being caught off guard a little bit when you change bikes and like different types of riding, like the gravel bike that I have has got very flared handlebars, and I actually really enjoy the position of your hands holding the handlebars at an angle, because the hubs of the brakes are just like angled in. I'm just trying to describe this like verbally because people can't see what I'm doing with my hands. But like it just, and then you go back on a road bike and you're like, oh, I feel, or if you go touring, like, and you load up the bike. That is hilarious. I remember going touring for like a week and going from a loaded gravel bike to a road bike. You feel so jittery. Like, yeah, it's good fun, all right? Like, everyone that's ridden track and has gone onto a road bike afterwards knows how it feels like to...
The transition break. From track. I'll go you one better because last year, or for the last couple of years, with a buddy of mine, we were on the tandem. So we rode the Worlds and stuff on the tandem last year. And going from a track tandem, because a tandem feels like you're towing a big long trailer with you. So mm-hmm. Even when you go from a tandem to a road bike, it feels weird. It feels like you're missing a piece on the back or it's loose or something. And then you add in the tandem track to the road bike. Oh, it's so bizarre.
I can imagine. I haven't ridden like a tandem or even a cargo bike, but I think that the ride feel is fairly different than when you back on a normal bike.
So how much of your identity now, and I know there's a buddy of mine at the moment, he's just retired from cycling, I was chatting to him a lot about his identity and how he sees himself. Obviously for a long time you were the rower and then you came into cycling. Did you get that full identity shift to now I'm a cyclist? Because you had some crazy events you've done on the bike. Like I was looking at the Davos 24 before. The call, like you've done some really nuts hardcore events on the mountain bike, hardcore.
It's funny because I think one of the reasons I didn't like want to continue with rowing was because I like to do different things. Like I'm not really like, I get bored I think pretty quickly with one type of anything. So then I went doing like multi-sport events. So I adventure raced for about 3 years after I had kind of finished rowing. I actually went and lived in Peru for 3 years. So that's a different story. And then when I came back,
hold on, I don't know if we can just leave that one there. What were you doing in Peru for 3 years?
I know, yeah. I got lost. No, I didn't.
You're chasing boys.
I was surfing and I was working as an English teacher. So when I quit rowing in 2005, I think it was, I became a teacher, like an English teacher. And then I ended up working in an international school in Lima in Peru for a few years. I've been traveling there. I made some friends, decided to go back down there and had a great few years. And then I came back to Europe in 2008 with the view towards doing a master's in education. But I actually ended up doing a postgraduate in communications, which because I started working for like a World Cup Adventuries, waiting to go back and do my HDIP or my Master's in Education, but changed tack completely, started adventure racing, did a postgrad in communications. And that led me to eventually to just cycling, because I was adventure racing. I went to live in Switzerland and I was doing loads of multi-sport events. So I was like running up and down the Alps and, you know, swim, cycle, run stuff, but in the Alps, like, so the races were like, we often had like 5,000 or 6,000 meters elevation across like the race. And then after a while, I was out of all the disciplines, cycling was my strongest, and I just dabbled in a little bit of racing. And then I started racing license and placing in the top like 5-10 women. And I was like, oh, you know what, I'll just carry on with this. And it's kind of what I enjoy to do the most. And the weekends, I was always out riding with my friends anyway. I mean, when we were riding on the weekends in Switzerland, it was insane stuff. Like, we were doing like, you know, we do rides like, you know, 4 alpine passes, like 5,000 meters of climbing, like 300 kilometers. Like, that was just Saturday, like, you know, and this is every weekend or every second weekend. Like, so I think at one point, or I don't know if I still am, but I was like in the top 1% of female climbers on Strava.
Oh my gosh.
I had like, I was just like pointing towards a mountain or an Alp, and I go up that pass, you know.
Well, there's definitely an inverse correlation for me between the amount of cycling I'm doing and any sort of achievement in the rest of my life. The rest of my life just falls apart the more I cycle.
But it's so true. Like, it just, like, my life was cycling. Like, I was working in the cycling industry. I was just racing or riding every weekend. I was like going to Tour Down Under, you know, like working on events in Adelaide, and like at the Tour de France, at the Arc de Triomphe final, like in the VIP box. Like, it's just, it was great, you know.
But it's a dream life for a cycling fan, or a cycling fanatic nearly as you.
Yeah. No, there was good times, you know, and I think it just got to the point though where I was like, I wasn't doing the whole like, is this it? Like, but I felt like I needed to move on in my career, and there weren't so many in the bike industry in Switzerland. And I was also questioning whether or not Switzerland was going to be the place for me to settle down in after, you know, 8 or 9 years in a place. You kind of go, is this where I really want to live now? And I kind of decided, look, I wanted a life that was a bit more, offered me a bit more freedom than working in an office, you know, because that is the daily reality. You know, social media, everything's great. You're flying around the place, having a great time. The reality of it is you're sitting at a desk from 9 until 5 every day, and you only see your family like once a year. So that's when the opportunity with Komoot came up, and I went for it. And because Komoot is a fully remote company, I knew that I could, like, you know, live maybe some of the year in somewhere like Portugal, or, you know, I don't know, Spain or France or whatever. And then I could live some of the year in Ireland and see my family. So that's what I did. I changed in 2017, I think it was. Yes, so I've been with Komoot now for 4 years.
And it's funny because, like, for the international listeners, Ireland's not especially big, and the cycling community isn't huge in Ireland either. And I've been riding a lot more gravel in the last couple of months, and I was looking for a tool for planning gravel routes, and I started using Komoot because Strava is shit for gravel. It's pretty shit for road as well, but it's especially shit for gravel. So I started using Komoot, but I was asking around, and we've some mutual friends in Velocio, because we're both brand ambassadors on Velocio. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, you notice a girl in Kerry that's like in yeah. I was like, no, trust me, there's not a girl in Kerry. You're getting Kerry and Zurich mixed up here.
It's so true. Like, there isn't, yeah, that's, I feel like I've been a little hidden in Kerry, like, but okay, to put a bit of like perspective or give some context there, the first 2 years I was working for Komoot, I was gone out of Ireland most of the year. Like, I'd come back, I'd spend like 2 or 3 weeks in Kerry, and then I was gone for like 2 weeks, and then we'd back for a few weeks. So I was on the go quite a lot. I didn't really get to like engage much in the Irish scene. And then And then I had a baby at Christmas time. So for most last year, I was pregnant. And there was also a lockdown. So it was very limiting and like also what you can do in terms of engagement. And now I have a baby. So I'm also not traveling around Ireland to go to events. It would have been like probably around now, I would have been thinking, OK, I'll sign up to some gravel events in Ireland. But it's also a bit of a...
And we also don't really have any.
Yeah, well, that's another story here, like, but yeah, I haven't exactly been in Ireland and like, you know, engaging much in the community here, although I would like to, but it's, yeah, you know, need a family and stuff now. It's also a matter of trying to find the time and keep everyone happy.
I'm going to pull you back into it because I feel like also commute's going to explode in Ireland because it's so like the download figures we were talking about, monthly active users, I can't remember figures, 20 million monthly active
20
users.
20 million users now, yeah.
Like it's blowing up around the world, but it's just you haven't really pressed the marketing on it in Ireland yet. So I feel like once that starts to come, you can't use commute and use Strava and go back to Strava. That's what I've been finding with it.
Yeah, like so commute is really targeting like people that like to stay active and like to be active in the outdoors, and it doesn't matter how fast or slow you go up or down a hill or over a certain segment. It's all about the experience and how you build outdoor experience into your life. So if you go out for a ride, even you enjoy your ride, you log it on commute as much as you would on Strava. You share pictures, you share a story, and then you'd engage with other people and what they've been doing on a daily or, you know, a weekly basis. And it removes the whole stress of the performance side of things that you would have from Strava, whereby when you go out, you've always got a needle in the back of your head that's going, oh, I wonder how fast I went over that, you know.
But you know, as a coach and, you know, even speaking for the other coaches in Roadman, I can't thank you guys enough for pulling away from this metric of average speed and segments, because it's such a disaster coaching athletes who are into this average speed culture. Because what you have is, you know, obviously you've trained for heart rate and stuff. When somebody's going out chasing average speed, they end up riding top of zone 3 sweet spot for their entire ride every single time because they're chasing a 30 kilometers an hour average speed on their loop. And while there's nothing intrinsically wrong with riding in that zone, you just get athletes who are very good at riding in that zone, and that's a disaster for racers because they can't go slow and they can't go fast. Mm-hmm. They just go kind of middle of the road. So it's such a nice move to see an app moving away from that sort of vanity metrics and back towards cycling and outdoor activity as fun.
It's all about, yeah, like, I mean, I think that there is a time and a place for everything in your life. Like if you're preparing for a race or preparing for an event, then that's what you're doing, and you use the tools that can support you in order to reach your goal for that event, whether it's training peaks or even if it's just something simple like, you know, parameters are expensive. Heart rate, okay, you use your heart rate, like, you know, but you don't need to be on it the whole time, like, because realistically, like, yes, if performance can be important to you, it's for in some phases, but for a lot of the time in your life, you don't need to be, you're not preparing for races. You could be just riding and looking up around you and enjoying, you know, either your friends that you're riding with or the scenery or, you know, the adventure that you planned for yourself, which is going to a new place to ride a different route or loop that you've not done before, and that has that nice coffee stop in a cafe that you've heard about but you haven't gone to. So, I mean, cycling or the outdoors can be enjoyed in so many different ways, and I think it's a shame if people just, you know, see it as the means to an end, like a road that you can use to make yourself fit, like, because that's only one part to it, and that also comes naturally as well the more you ride and the more you enjoy your riding. So commute's there to, I suppose, promote that aspect of life, people's lifestyles.
So there's one feature that I'm using just nonstop. Like I'm doing a gravel route later on this evening. So I was mucking about before our call planning my route. So I literally stuck in my start point. And then I zoomed into these. I don't know what they're actually called inside commute. I just call, is it hidden gems?
Highlights.
Yeah. So I'm literally looking and going, right, boom, highlight one, highlight two, and I'm joining up highlights for my route because are they crowdsourced or the commute add them in?
They're crowdsourced, but they appear on the map based on how well they've been verified by the community. So for anyone listening in, commute is kind of like, without wanting to compare too much, but commute could be seen as like the trip advisor of the outdoors. So when you look at the map on the app, you'll see all these red dots, and they're highlights that have been left or created by other users in the app that are, you know, anything from like a nice cafe to stop and have a break to a viewpoint to even bike shops, or, you know, like a picnic place if you want to stop, and if you're camping or something, you can camp there and have, you know, put a fire down or whatever. So the goal of those is for people to be able to communicate what, you know, are highlights in the outdoor area that you're planning a route in. So you can use them then to just plan from, you know, to add to your route. So when you know that every 20 or 30 or 40 kilometers, there's going to be a break for a specific reason or whatever. And that's what really sets us apart from a lot of our competitors as well, like, which just have points of interest, which are
And a few of them where I've kind of been, like, I was planning out the route, and it's fresh in my mind because I was literally doing it before the call. And I'm like, well, do I want to go east or do I want to go west here? And they say a highlight point on each side. But you can click on the highlight point and it'll bring up a photo if somebody's uploaded one and show you what you kind of have to look forward to. So I click on it like, oh, that looks a little bit too gnarly for the gravel bike. I'm going to go with this one. And you can kind of navigate. I know, it just adds a nice extra dimension to it.
Yeah, because the highlights can be segments as well. So they can be a place or it can be a segment. So I've used them a lot for, mountain bike planning, route planning. So especially, it's hard to kind of explain how advanced commute is in Europe, because when you look at highlights in Europe, you might have like, there's some highlights of like 200 or 300 photos of the place added to the highlight by users, by people that have been there, together with descriptions and the most latest information on what the condition of the trail is, or whether it's open or closed based on the time of year. And also in the premium version of commute, you get like information about when that highlight is mostly visited, like what time of the year is busiest, what the weather forecast is going to be like there, and even UV index.
See, this is why I need to get more Irish people on it, because it gets stronger the more you use it. So get downloading it, because I need more highlights for my...
From a selfish perspective. There's loads of highlights in Kerry because I've added them.
So I'm actually planning a trip in a couple of weekends' time with four or five friends. We're going to do the Wicklow Way, and we're going to split it into 2 days. So we're going to ride, I guess it's going to be like a 6-7 hour day with all our luggage, camp, and, you know, fire and stuff, and then ride again the next day. So I'm going to plan a bunch of, or I'm going to take pictures and plot a bunch of highlights along the Wicklow Way, so people can definitely follow in my footsteps on that one.
When you've done that route, you should definitely share it with people, so they can then, you can just add, if you're on commute and you see someone else's route, you can just like basically take it into your profile. You can add it to your own profile, and you can go out, and so people could go out and just ride your route afterwards then, within commute, like, so you can navigate with commute as well with your smartphone, which is kind of handy. In fact, for most of the riding I do now, I don't even bother with the GPS on the bike, like with the computer. I just stick the app on my phone.
Really, I haven't tried that yet. So I feel like I'm the Christopher Columbus of the Wicklow Mountains here. I'm trying to plot the gravel routes, but I'm going down a lot of dead ends. So I'm hopeful that if I just upload all my files to commute and other people start doing the same, that we're actually going to have a nice tapestry, because there's so many trails. We're blessed to have so many trails right on the Wicklow Mountains. And I know you have great trails in Kerry as well. And it's maybe a little segue into the last thing I want to talk about, because I've only started riding off-road a little bit. I know you've much more experience than I do, off-roading, adventure. One thing that's kind of annoyed me so far with off-road is, I don't want to say it's walkers, because it's not walkers. It's the segmentation of what's already a small community. Like, the outdoor active community is a small community, and I feel like we should be all together. But it's like, some people are like, no, I'm in this niche in the outdoor active community, and you're in this niche in the outdoor active community, and it's not compatible. Like,
yeah, it's very tough in Ireland, to be honest. When I moved back here 4 years ago, I didn't realize how difficult it would be for me to pursue my passions in terms of cycling, because you just keep on coming up against these, you know, barriers in terms of like land access, and a lot of it is related to the infamous insurance issues that we've had in the country, and, you know, private property or state property not being accessible to people that are, you know, into the outdoors. In Wicklow, or for people living in Dublin, you're in a very, very fortunate position that Caolta have, you know, looked at the whole area of the Wicklow Mountains basically and said, look, this is an area that can be reused or offered to the Irish people in terms of recreation. And this is a standalone area pretty much in Ireland where you've got a huge expanse of beautiful forestry that Caolta have now said, look, this has a very high value for recreational users. Now it's up to the recreational users to be very, I think, respectful and open to the fact that it's not just for walkers, it's for cyclists, mountain bikers, gravel cyclists, lots of different types of people.
Yeah, I feel like even the same way that if someone comes out on a group ride on the road, there's like a set of customs and traditions, and as an experienced rider in a group, it's almost my role within the group to indoctrinate them and show them the ways. Yeah. I feel like we need the same around, you know, just basic respect for trail erosion, you know, closing gates after you, stuff like that.
Oh, there's such a gap in Irish people's knowledge and education in with regards to how you behave in the outdoors. And I don't even know where you would access materials to inform yourself apart from, you know, joining some of the organizations, but even the organizations lack the resources to educate people at that level. So, and especially in the last year and a half, there's been such a fantastic increase of people, you know, taking advantage of what we have on our doorstep, but people do lack the education and knowledge on how to, what's the code of conduct in the outdoors in Ireland? Could you actually list, what are the top 10 most important things? I think it should be drilled into kids in school as well, you know, so.
And it's basic stuff like, you know, picking up after you, like with the big increase in footfall on the trails, you're saying people think it's Temple Bar, it's O'Connell Street, that someone's coming picking up after you. Like if you drop plastics on the trails, like they could be there for the next 10 years, like.
Yeah, and when it comes to route planning as well, you know, another thing that we have come across quite frequently is people use apps and they think that, oh, the app, right, like I was able to make a trail that, you know, was 50 kilometers long in the mountains and I've ridden it. So therefore, because I could create the trail, I was, you know, like approved, I was allowed to ride that trail. That's not always the case. Like there's the outdoors is also, or like, you know, land is, it's a dynamic thing. I mean, sometimes land has been purchased by a private landowner and therefore the access, you're not allowed to go into that land anymore. It's up to you as a responsible person in the outdoors to inform yourself about what the access laws are and whether or not you're entitled to be in that place or not. And what the consequences are if you do trespass, or how you can work with the landowners on the other side of things. Can you ask the person that owns the land, you know, if you can ride across it? In Kerry, we see that quite a lot. Like, what's private land, you know, you're technically not allowed to go across that land unless you have permission, but it's just as easy sometimes to knock on a door and say, hey, there's a lovely trail going across your farm, and do you mind if I ride it every now and then?
And you know what? Most of them are pretty sound. Like we're organizing at the moment a gravel event in Tipperary for September, and the September date hasn't been confirmed yet, but it's going to be going across a lot of private land. But almost every landowner who we approached, they're so happy to have people there to see the land getting used, mm-hmm. but it's just not taken that for granted, and it's asking them politely like you would for anything else.
Yeah, and if everyone Like I said, like this is like this conversation I was turned into, like if we like, you know, almost like, you know, telling people how they should behave, and it's not meant to be like that. But I think if more people were informed about what, how you should behave and what's the right way to do things when you are in the outdoors, you know, we wouldn't get tagged with these, you know, we wouldn't be like described as, oh, the cyclists that are ruining the trails, or, you know, the hikers that are letting their dogs run wild across the fields and chasing the sheep. So I think everyone just needs to make more of an effort in Ireland as well to behave better in the outdoors, and then we'd have more opportunities to use the outdoors as we'd like to.
And if people do follow my commute routes, they should be warned, you will be wading through rivers, scaling up the side of mountains, because I get lost so much. Fiona, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to us on the Roadman Cycling Podcast. I'll link up information to you and commute and my profile and all those bits in the bio down below for people. But thanks for chatting.
Lovely. Thanks a million, Anthony. Have a lovely day.
Cheers.
Bye.
Hey everybody, it's Anthony again. Really quick, I want to invite you to join arguably the best thing I've ever put out inside the Roadman community. It's a challenge. It's a challenge called the 14-day Kickstart Challenge. So regardless of where your fitness is at right now, this is going to be the catalyst for making you faster and making you leaner. I've created this challenge to take the guesswork out of everything. It's 14 days of training plans, regardless of what your level is. There's masters, beginner, advanced. There's meal plans, shopping list, and even a video course holding your hand and talking you through it all. So what I recommend you do right now is just stop everything, press pause on this audio, and go to roadmancycling.com/14-day, or check out the link in the bio. That's roadmancycling.com/14-day.